color, it was the best. And so long as he ran Tiffany, it was the best. I'd seen him at parties, and he was a man with impeccable manners, perfect white hair, beautifully tailored suits, and an imperial style. If you were casting a movie about the president of Tiffany, Walter Hoving would get the part. I decided to be very direct. I called Hoving on the phone and introduced myself. I was very polite and very respectful, and he agreed to see me. By this time, Durstgut had done a scale model of the building I hoped to build, as well as one for an alternative building in the event that I didn't get Tiffany's air rights. I brought both models to the meeting. I said to Hoving, "Look, I want to buy your air rights, because that will allow me to build a much better building that you yourself will like much more. By selling me air rights, you will preserve Tiffany forever. No one will ever be able to build over it, and therefore no one will ever try to rip it down." The other reason to sell, I told Hoving, was that if I didn't have his air rights, for technical reasons, the city would require me to put in lot-line windows, tiny little windows with wire mesh, which would look absolutely horrible, rising up 50 stories directly over Tiffany. With his air rights, on the other hand, I'd be permitted to put in beautiful picture windows on the side of the building overlooking Tiffany. At that point, I showed Hoving the two models. One, a magnificent building, which is essentially the design of Trump Tower today. The other, my hideous alternative. "I'm offering you $5 million, I said to Walter Hoving, "to let me preserve Tiffany. In return, you're selling me something, air rights, that you'd never use anyway." Hoving had been at Tiffany almost 25 years. He'd built it into an incredible success, and naturally, he took great personal pride in his creation. I was playing to that, and it worked. He immediately liked my concept. "Look, young man," he said, "I am going to make a deal with you at the price you've suggested. I just hope that you do as nice a job as you say you will, because I want to be proud of it. In the meantime, I have one small problem. I'm going away with my wife for a month, and I won't have time to devote to this until I get back." Immediately I started to get nervous. I said, "Gee, Mr. Hoving, that's a big problem, because if I have your air rights, I can build a totally different building. And that's the basis on which I'm going to seek my zoning variance. If for some reason you change your mind while you're away, I'll have done a great deal of architectural work and zoning work, which I'll just have to throw out." Walter Hoving looked at me as if I'd insulted him. "Young man," he said, "perhaps you didn't understand. I shook your hand. I made a deal with you. That's that." I was speechless. You have to understand where I was coming from. While there are certainly honorable people in the real estate business, I was more accustomed to the sort of people with whom you don't want to waste the effort of a handshake because you know it's meaningless. I'm talking about the lowlifes, the horror shows with whom nothing counts but a signed contract. With Walter Hoving, I realized, I was dealing with a totally different type. A gentleman who was genuinely shocked at any suggestion that he might renege on a deal. He also had a way of talking down, so that he actually made me feel a little guilty for even suggesting that anything could possibly go wrong in our deal. As it happened, Walter Hoving went away, and no sooner had he left than Philip Morris made a deal to buy the air rights over Grand Central at a price far in excess of what I'd agreed to pay for the Tiffany air rights, which were in a much better location. Then, during that same month, several more air rights deals were made, also for very big numbers. Quite simply, New York City was recovering, and the real estate market was beginning to go through the roof. I knew Hoving was honorable, but I couldn't help worrying about how he was going to feel when he heard about those other deals. Several days after he returned, we met to talk over some points in our deal. Sure enough, even as we sat down, two of his executives began to try to talk him out of making the deal by pointing out what had happened in the market. I was upset. But I could see very quickly that Hoving was even more upset. "Gentlemen," he said, "I shook hands with this young man over a month ago. When I make a deal, that's the deal, whether it's a good one or a bad one, and I trust I won't have to explain myself again." That was the end of that. Later, I heard that Hoving went even a step further. During the same period, he'd apparently decided to make another deal, much bigger than the one with me, to sell Tiffany to the Avon Corporation. I thought Avon was a rather second-rate buyer for a classy store like Tiffany. On the other hand, they'd offered to pay such an inflated price that I couldn't blame Hoving for agreeing to sell. However, as one of the conditions of its purchase, Avon wanted Hoving to agree not to go through with the air rights deal with me. Hoving, I heard, stood totally firm. If Avon had a problem with the air rights deal, he told their executives, then they didn't have to buy his store. They dropped the demand and bought the store, and my deal went through. Walter Hoving was just a totally honorable, totally classy man. That's exactly what made him such a brilliant retailer, and it's why Tiffany has never been the same since he left. I'll give you a small example. Hoving had a policy at Tiffany that when his best customers came in, they could pick out what they wanted, sign for it, and be billed later. It was very simple and very elegant. No sooner did Avon take over than their team of accountants started instituting new policies, including the introduction of little blue plastic Tiffany credit cards. That was fine, except that all of a sudden, Tiffany's best customers were told that they, too, had to use the little plastic cards. It was not only stupid, it was self-defeating. You want your best customers to feel special. Before very long, Hoving, who'd agreed at first to stay on as a consultant, got fed up and left. That just made things worse. As long as Hoving ran Tiffany, for example, you'd never see peddlers out front on the street, selling fake watches and cheap jewelry, blocking pedestrians and degrading Fifth Avenue. Whenever Walter Hoving saw a peddler, he'd go to his people, and he'd start screaming, in his dignified manner, "How dare you let them do that?" And within minutes, the peddler would be gone. But as soon as Hoving left, a dozen street peddlers immediately set up shop in front of Tiffany, and they haven't moved since. However, I learned a lesson from Walter Hoving. I now employ some very large security people who make absolutely sure that the street in front of Trump Tower is kept clean, pristine, and free of peddlers. Once I got Tiffany's air rights, there was just one more parcel I needed. Adjacent to Tiffany's along 57th Street, and leased by Bonwit, was a tiny site, perhaps 4,000 square feet, that was critical if I was going to build the building I had in mind. Under the zoning regulations, you're required to have a minimum of 30 feet of open space, a rear yard, behind any building. Without this last piece, I would have been forced to chop the rear yard out of the building we'd already designed. And that would have been a disaster. The piece I wanted was owned by a man named Leonard Candell. By buying the overall Bonwit lease, I effectively controlled the site. But once again, my problem was a short lease. It had less than 20 years to run and also included provisions that made any zoning changes practically impossible. Fortunately, Leonard Candell, like Hoving, is a totally honorable man. Leonard began in real estate by buying apartment buildings in the Bronx in the 30s and 40s. But unlike most small landlords, he decided to get out when he saw rent control coming. He sold all his buildings and came to Manhattan, where he began buying up leaseholds on prime property, meaning the land under buildings. As the market rose, Leonard became very rich, and with none of the problems of having to run the buildings himself. Meanwhile, the landlords who stayed in the Bronx went down the tubes, because sure enough, rent control proved to be a disaster for them. One reason I'd left Brooklyn and my father's business was to escape rent control. And so from the start, Leonard and I had an affinity. My problem was that Leonard wasn't a seller. It wasn't a matter of price, or that he had any particular attachment to his 57th Street parcel. It was simply that Leonard didn't sell anything, on the theory that in the long run, land prices in Manhattan were headed in only one direction, and that was up. He was exactly right, of course. And though we got along fine, Leonard wouldn't budge. Then one day I discovered an unexpected bonus in my Tiffany deal. I was reviewing my air rights contract when I came across a clause that gave Tiffany an option to purchase the adjoining Candell property within a certain time frame. I said to myself, holy Christmas, this could give me a lever to make a deal with Leonard. So I went back to Walter and I said, listen, you're never going to buy that Candell site. So would you mind if I also bought your option as part of my deal? Walter agreed. We put it into my deal, and immediately I exercised the option. At first, Leonard took the position that I didn't have the right to exercise the option because it belonged to Tiffany, and therefore was non-transferable. Leonard may have been right, but it was also possible, in a litigation, that I would win the right to exercise the option. When I pointed this out to Leonard, we sat down together, and in no more than 20 minutes, we made a deal that was good for both of us. I agreed to withdraw my exercise of the option, and in return, Leonard agreed to extend my lease on the site from 20 years to 100 years, which was long enough to make it financeable. He also rewrote the lease to eliminate any prohibitions against rezoning. And while I agreed to pay a slightly higher rent, it was still very low for a long lease on such a prime site. Leonard and I shook hands, and we've remained very good friends. It's funny how things turn around. Leonard is an older man, and in the past couple of years he's begun giving thought to his heirs and his estate. Early in 1986, he called and said he'd like to make me a gift of a 15% interest in the land under the Ritz-Carlton Hotel on Central Park South, which is one of his more valuable holdings. In addition, he gave me control over the disposition of the land when the hotel's lease comes up in approximately 25 years. His purpose, Leonard told me, was to put the land in the hands of someone he thought would get the most value from it, which in turn would benefit his heirs, who retain a majority ownership. Leonard is a very generous man, and he is also very smart. I'll be fighting like hell for the Candell family. By the time I got the Candell site on 57th Street, it was December 1978, and I was in a delicate situation. I'd pieced together everything I needed. I'd managed to keep the deal completely secret, but I still had no contract with Genesco. As 1979 began, my lawyers were still discussing a few final points with the Genesco lawyers, and we expected to sign contracts no later than February. But in mid-January, word finally began to leak out to the real estate community that Genesco might be making a deal to sell the Bonwit site. Just as I'd predicted, Genesco was immediately besieged with interested buyers for the property, among them wealthy Arabs with oil boom money to burn. And sure enough, Genesco suddenly began trying to back out of the deal. Even as our contract was being prepared, it became clear that if Genesco could find a way to break the deal, it would. It was then that I thanked my lucky stars I'd gotten that one-page letter of intent from Jack Hannigan. Without it, there was zero chance my deal would have gone through. I'm not at all sure the letter would have proved legally binding, but at the very least I could have litigated it and held up any sale of the Bonwit property for several years. Naturally, I let Genesco know I fully intended to do just that if they reneged on my deal. With creditors breathing down their necks, Genesco, I knew, didn't have a lot of time. On the morning of January 20th, I got a call that proved to be a blessing. It was from D. Wiedemeyer, a reporter from the New York Times, who wanted to know if it was true that I was about to make a deal with Genesco to buy the Bonwit building. Genesco, still seeking a way out, had declined to give Wiedemeyer any comment. But I decided to take a calculated risk. I'd tried very hard to keep the deal as secret as possible until I had a signed contract, because I didn't want to prompt a bidding war. But now the rumors were circulating, and I had a seller who was balking. So I confirmed for Wiedemeyer that I'd reached an agreement with Genesco for the property, and that because I anticipated building a new tower on the site, Bonwit would most likely be closed within the next several months. My idea was to put public pressure on Genesco to live up to their agreement. What I didn't calculate was a secondary benefit. No sooner did Wiedemeyer's article appear the next morning than all of Bonwit's best employees began heading over to Bergdorf Goodman, Saks Fifth Avenue, and Bloomingdale's to look for new jobs. Suddenly, Bonwit began losing its best people in droves, and it was becoming almost impossible to run the store. That, I believe, was the straw that broke Genesco's back. Suddenly, they stopped balking. 5 days after the New York Times article appeared, we signed our contract. The company's desperation saved my deal. On the other hand, desperation can be a double-edged sword. Because Genesco needed cash so badly and so quickly, they insisted on a very unusual contract. In a typical real estate deal, you put down a 10% deposit when you sign a contract, and the remaining 90% at closing. Instead, Genesco demanded that I put down 50% at contract, $12.5 million, and the other half at closing. My lawyers advised me not to agree to such a demand. The way they saw it, there was a reasonable risk that the company might go bankrupt before we ever got to closing. If that happened, a bankruptcy judge, who has powers you wouldn't believe, might choose to take my deposit and use it to pay off other creditors. For me to put so much money at such risk, my lawyer said, was totally imprudent. I looked at it another way. I wasn't thrilled about putting $12.5 million on the line. But at the same time, I believed that the more cash I gave Genesco, the more money they'd have to pay off debts and keep their creditors at bay. Also, my period of risk would be relatively short, since it was in our mutual interest to close the deal as quickly as possible. The time between contract and closing is often 6 months or more. In this case, we set it at 60 days. In addition, I already had a good deal of time and money invested in the deal. As far back as August, following my first meeting with Jack Hannigan, I'd begun working on plans for the site, and I'd started negotiating with the city for zoning. Actually, within minutes of leaving Jack Hannigan's office, I had called Der Scott and asked him to meet me at the Bonwit site. When he got there, I pointed to the building, and I asked him what he thought. It was obviously a super location, he said, but what did I have in mind for it? I want to build the most fantastic building in New York, I told Durr, and I want you to get working right away, because I want to know how big a building I can legally build. From the start, size was a top priority. With such a great location, the more apartments I could build, the better the return I could hope to get on my investment. Moreover, the higher I could go, the better the views, and the more I could charge for the apartments. A guy named Arthur Drexler, from the Museum of Modern Art, put it very well when he said, "Skyscrapers are machines for making money." Drexler meant it as a criticism. I saw it as an incentive. From the start, everyone I talked with was skeptical that I could get approval to build a huge glass skyscraper along a stretch of Fifth Avenue filled with short, old limestone and brick buildings. I'd heard the same thing about the Hyatt, of course, and so I didn't take the warnings too seriously. Even putting commercial considerations aside, I felt a tall building would be much more striking than a short one. Very quickly, Durr got caught up in my enthusiasm. When someone complained at a community board hearing that the building we had in mind was too tall and would block too much light, Durr answered, only half kidding, "If you want sunlight, move to Kansas." For any new building, the permissible height is determined by something called floor area ratio, FAR. Specifically, the total square footage of a building can be no more than a certain multiple of the square footage of the building lot. It was possible to get some bonuses, but on this lot, for example, the absolute maximum FAR was 21.6. Naturally, that's what I intended to go after. I knew it was going to be an uphill battle. When Durr did his first computations, using just the Bonwit site without Tiffany's air rights or the Candel parcel, he determined that our maximum FAR was 8.5. which he said translated into a 20-story building with 10,000 square feet of usable space per floor. Immediately, I told him to transform it into a 40-story building with 5,000 square feet per floor. Not only would that give me apartments with better views, it would also mean fewer apartments per floor, which is another luxury for which buyers will pay a premium. Of course, I had no intention of settling for a low FAR. For starters, my FAR would increase substantially when I acquired the Tiffany air rights. In addition, developers can get extra FAR by providing certain amenities that the City Planning Commission deems desirable. On this site, for example, I could get a bonus by building residential units instead of just offices, on the theory that office buildings create far more pedestrian traffic and congestion. In addition, I could get a bonus by building a public area for pedestrians, something called a through-block arcade, on my ground floor. I could get a third bonus by building more than the minimum retail space required by law. And I could get a final bonus by building a public park within the shopping area and arcade. Eager for every advantage I could get, I began talking to Durr about designing an atrium with several levels of shopping. As a business, a retail atrium seemed a long shot. Enclosed shopping malls have been a hit all across the country, but they've almost never succeeded in New York City. The typical suburban mall is clean, controlled, safe, and antiseptic, which is exactly why most people feel so comfortable in them. New Yorkers, on the other hand, seem to thrive on gritty street life and are quite happy to do business with street vendors. But the way I figured it, even if the atrium wasn't terribly successful, the bonus I'd get for building it, several extra floors in my residential tower, would more than make up for its cost. It wasn't until much later when I began to see how magnificently it was turning out, and when we started to attract the best stores in the world as tenants, that I realized the atrium was going to be something special, a hit on its own terms. In the early stages, I focused more of my attention on the design of the building itself. I wanted to create something memorable and monumental. But I also knew that without a unique design, we'd never get approval for a very big building. The standard four-sided glass box just wasn't going to fly with city planning. Durr went to work. He probably did 3 to 4 dozen drawings, and as we went along, I picked the best elements from each one. At first, we started out with a glass tower built on a rectangular limestone base. But that just didn't look good. Later, we tried a design with 3 exterior glass elevators. That appealed to me, but it turned out that they'd use up far too much of our saleable interior space. Finally, Durr came up with the concept of a series of terraces stepped back from the street to the height of the adjacent Tiffany building. My wife, Ivana, and I agreed that the setbacks created a certain compatibility and gave our building a less bulky feeling than it would have with straight sides, like most skyscrapers have. On the higher floors, we settled on a sawtooth design, a zigzag effect that gave the building 28 different sides, as if you took the steps of a staircase and turned them on their side. The design was obviously going to be more expensive to execute than something more standard, but the advantages seemed obvious. With 28 surfaces, we'd be creating a striking, distinctive building. Also, the multiple sides would ensure at least 2 views from every room, and in the end, that would make it possible to charge more for the apartments. To me, we were creating the best of all possible worlds. It was a great-looking design, but it was also very saleable. To hit a real home run, you need both. The next challenge was to have the design approved by the city, which meant, among other things, getting zoning variances. In one key case, we were able to prevail simply by using logic. The zoning law required that we build a ground floor through-block arcade that ran north-south, meaning from 57th Street to 56th Street. That would have meant putting the entrance to the building on 57th Street rather than on 5th Avenue, and the latter was obviously more prestigious. We simply pointed out to city planning that the IBM building, between our site and Madison Avenue, already had a north-south through-block arcade, so that ours would be redundant. By running our arcade on a west-east axis, we could connect from Fifth Avenue through to IBM's atrium, and therefore all the way out to Madison Avenue. Remarkably, everyone agreed that was the best solution. The result was that we got the variance that allowed us to create our spectacular entrance on Fifth Avenue. What the city balked at, from the very start, was the size of the building we were proposing. 70 stories high, with square footage at the maximum 21.6 FAR. As early as December 1978, even before I'd closed my deal with Bonwit, city planning let us know that they'd considered our proposed building too big. They said they intended to oppose letting us use bonuses to increase our FAR, and that they were very concerned about the issue of compatibility with the smaller, surrounding buildings on Fifth Avenue. Fortunately, by the time I closed my deal in early 1979, and we entered into serious discussions with city planning, I had some ammunition of my own. For starters, I could have chosen to build something called an as-of-right building, one that doesn't require any variances. Much the way I'd done earlier with Walter Hoving, I had Durr prepare a model of the as-of-right building to show city planning. It was hideous. A thin little four-sided box going straight up 80 stories, cantilevering over Tiffany's. We took the position that if the city wouldn't approve the building we wanted, we were prepared to build as of right, as we showed them the model and the renderings. Naturally, they were horrified. I'm not sure they believed we'd ever build it, or even that it was buildable, but there was no way they could be sure. The next thing I was able to use in my favor, unexpectedly, was Bonwit Teller itself. At first, I assumed I'd just tear down the store, and that would be the end of it. But very shortly after I'd signed my deal for the site, another company, Allied Stores Corporation, made a deal with Genesco to purchase the 12 remaining Bonwit Teller branches in locations ranging from Palm Beach, Florida, to Beverly Hills, California. Soon after that, the president and CEO of Allied, a terrific retailing executive named Thomas Machocci, approached me. Allied itself had been very close to bankruptcy when Machocci took it over in 1966. But over the next 10 years, he transformed it into one of the strongest retailing companies in the country. Machocci explained to me that while several of the Bonwit stores he'd just purchased were quite successful, he felt it was critical to continue to have the flagship Bonwit in Manhattan. And ideally, he said, he'd like to keep the store at 57th Street and 5th Avenue, not only because it had been there for 50 years, but also because the location was unbeatable. I told Tom right off that there was no way I could give Bonwit nearly as much space as it previously had. On the other hand, I said, I could give him good space, fronting on 57th Street and connected directly through to the atrium I intended to build on my ground floor. I showed him my plans, and in a very short time, we were able to strike a deal. It was very good for Tom, because we signed a long-term lease and a rent per square foot far below what I later got for other retail space in the building. But it was also very good for me. I leased 55,000 square feet to Allied, giving them a store less than one-quarter the size of the original Bonwit, for an annual rent of $3 million, plus a percentage of their profits. I'd paid $25 million to purchase Bonwit's lease and building, and with a 10% mortgage, my carrying costs were approximately $2.5 million a year. In other words, I was paying out $2.5 million to own the site and getting $3 million back from Allied for leasing them a small portion of the total space. That meant I had a profit of $500,000 a year and owned the land for nothing, all guaranteed before I even began construction. Better yet, since I was giving the new Bonwit only a small portion of my site, I could rent the rest to other retailers. But perhaps best of all, what I got in Bonwit was a store the city very much wanted to keep in New York. I was able to make a very simple, very strong case to the people at the City Planning Commission. If you want Bonwit to return to Fifth Avenue, I told them, you're going to have to give me my zoning. Even with that, my approval was far from a sure thing. The local community board opposed such a tall building. As a ploy, they suggested a 6-month moratorium on new buildings to study whether the area was already overbuilt. A committee to ban the building boom sprang up. As soon as that happened, politicians had a knee-jerk reaction. They latched on to the cause. Looking back, I don't think politics or leverage made a critical difference one way or the other. I'm absolutely convinced that it was the architecture itself that won us our approval. And perhaps no one had a more powerful influence than Ada Louise Huxtable, then the chief architecture critic of the New York Times. I took a calculated risk by inviting Huxtable to look at our model and renderings before the City Planning Commission voted on our zoning. The power of the New York Times is just awesome. It is certainly one of the most influential institutions in the world. And I recognized that anything Huxtable wrote would have enormous impact. Moreover, I knew that she was hostile to skyscrapers in general, and that she almost always preferred old and classical to new and glitzy. But by the middle of 1979, I was worried about whether I was going to get my zoning. I figured that Huxtable couldn't make things worse, and that if I got lucky, she might write something that would help. In early June, Huxtable came to see our plans. On Sunday, July 1st, the Times Arts and Leisure section carried her Architecture View column about Trump Tower. It was titled, "A New York Blockbuster of Superior Design." That headline probably did more for my zoning than any single thing I ever said or did. The funny thing was that Huxtable spent the first half of her review complaining that our building was too big and suggesting that I had used every trick in the book to maximize its size. But interestingly, she didn't blame me so much as she did the city for zoning laws that she said encouraged developers to do what I'd done. And then, at the end, she gave us several terrific lines. "A great deal of care has been lavished on its design," she wrote, adding, "It is undeniably a dramatically handsome structure." In October, the Planning Commission unanimously approved our zoning. The commission said it would have preferred a masonry facade for Trump Tower, as more compatible with neighboring buildings, but added that they didn't insist, in light of the fact that I would be providing extraordinary public amenities. In the end, we negotiated an FAR of 21, barely less than the 21.6 maximum. I settled for just 2 fewer floors than I'd originally sought. That gave me the equivalent of a 68-story building, including the huge double-ceilinged 6-level atrium, which made Trump Tower the tallest residential building in the city. At the same time, the city took Huxtable's comments about the zoning laws to heart, responding to the way I'd used bonuses and air rights to create a much bigger building. The city amended its zoning laws to prevent others from doing the same thing in the future. Once I had my zoning, the next challenge was getting the tower built. It wasn't going to be cheap. When you build above a certain height, construction costs rise almost geometrically, simply because it becomes so much more costly to do everything, from reinforcing the infrastructure to bringing up piping. On the other hand, because I had such a prime location, I felt I could afford it. If I did the job right, I'd be able to charge such a premium that the extra cost would be irrelevant. In October 1980, Chase Manhattan agreed to provide financing for the construction of Trump Tower. I made a deal with HRH Construction to be my general contractor. The budget for the whole job, acquisition of the land, construction, carrying charges, advertising, and promotion, was slightly more than $200 million. The person I hired to be my personal representative overseeing the construction, Barbara Ress, was the first woman ever put in charge of a skyscraper in New York. She was 33 at the time. She'd worked for HRH, and I'd met her on the Commodore job, where she'd worked as a mechanical superintendent. I'd watched her in construction meetings, and what I liked was that she took no guff from anyone. She was half the size of most of these bruising guys, but she wasn't afraid to tell them off when she had to, and she knew how to get things done. It's funny, my own mother was a housewife all her life, and yet it's turned out that I've hired a lot of women for top jobs, and they've been among my best people. Often, in fact, they are far more effective than the men around them. Louise Sunshine, who was an executive vice president in my company for 10 years, was as relentless a fighter as you'll ever meet. Blanche Sprague, the executive vice president who handles all sales and oversees the interior design of my buildings, is one of the best salespeople and managers I've ever met. Norma Forderer, my executive assistant, is sweet and charming and very classy, but she's steel underneath. And people who think she can be pushed around find out very quickly that they're mistaken. Ivana, my wife, is a great manager who treats her employees very well, but she's also very demanding and very competitive. Her employees respect her because they know she's pushing herself as hard as she's pushing them. We began demolition of the Bonwit building on March 15, 1980, and almost immediately I found myself in the middle of a major controversy over the two bas-relief Art Deco sculptures that were a decorative feature of the exterior of the building. All during 1979, long after I'd announced my plans and begun negotiating for zoning, no one expressed any interest in those friezes. No representative from zoning, from landmarks preservation, or from any community arts group ever suggested saving them. Finally, in mid-December of 1979, shortly before I was to begin construction, I got a call from someone at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, asking if I'd consider donating the friezes and certain iron grill work. I said that if the friezes could be saved, I'd be happy to donate them to the museum. What happened was that we began the demolition, and when it came time to take down the friezes, my guys came to me and they said, "Mr. Trump, these are a lot heavier than we thought, and that if you want to try to save them, we're going to have to add special scaffolding for safety's sake, and it's going to take at least several weeks." My carrying charges on the construction loan for this project were enormous, not to mention the extra construction costs of delaying the job. I just wasn't prepared to lose hundreds of thousands of dollars to save a few Art Deco sculptures that I believed were worth considerably less, and perhaps not very much at all. So I ordered my guys to rip them down. What I didn't count on was the outrage this would create. The following day, the New York Times ran a front-page picture of the workmen demolishing the sculptures, and the next thing I knew, I'd become a symbol of everything evil about modern developers. A Times editorial described the demolition as a memorable version of cash flow calculations outweighing public sensibilities, and went on to say that, obviously, big buildings do not make big human beings, nor do big deals make art experts. It was not the sort of publicity you like to get. Looking back, I regret that I had the sculptures destroyed. I'm not convinced they were truly valuable, and I still think that a lot of my critics were phonies and hypocrites, but I understand now that certain events can take on a symbolic importance. Frankly, I was too young, and perhaps in too much of a hurry to take that into account. The point is that, despite what some people may think, I'm not looking to be a bad guy when it isn't absolutely necessary. Ironically, the whole controversy may have ended up being a plus for me in terms of selling Trump Tower. The stories that appeared about it invariably started with sentences like, "In order to make way for one of the world's most luxurious buildings," even though the publicity was almost entirely negative, there was a great deal of it, and that drew a tremendous amount of attention to Trump Tower. Almost immediately we saw an upsurge in the sales of apartments. I'm not saying that's a good thing, and in truth, it probably says something perverse about the culture we live in. But I'm a businessman, and I learned a lesson from that experience. Good publicity is preferable to bad. But from a bottom-line perspective, bad publicity is sometimes better than no publicity at all. Controversy, in short, sells. So, it turned out, does glamour. Even before we started construction, I'd begun to realize that the atrium could prove to be one of the most dazzling parts of Trump Tower. At first, we just set out to make it an attractive setting for retailers. But when I saw the final drawings in the model, I realized it could be truly spectacular. I also decided I would spend whatever it took to assure that it lived up to its potential. Perhaps the best example is the marble. Originally, I thought of using the brown Paradiso that had been so successful for the lobby of the Grand Hyatt. But in the end, I became convinced that what was great for a hotel lobby wasn't necessarily right for a retail shopping atrium. Der, Ivana, and I looked at hundreds of marble samples. Finally, we came upon something called Breccia Pernici, a rare marble in a color none of us had ever seen before. An exquisite blend of rose, peach, and pink that literally took our breath away. Of course, it was incredibly expensive, in part because it was a very irregular marble. When we went to the quarry, we discovered that much of the marble contained large white spots and white veins. That was jarring to me and took away from the beauty of the stone. So we ended up going to the quarry with black tape and marking off the slabs that were the best. The rest we just scrapped, maybe 60% of the total. By the time we were finished, we'd taken the whole top of the mountain and used up much of the quarry. Next, I made sure to get the finest craftsmen to cut and lay the marble, because unless your workmen are the best, you get jagged edges, poor matching, and asymmetry, and then you've lost the whole effect. That effect was heightened by the fact that we used so much marble, on the floors and for the walls 6 full floors up. It created a very luxurious and a very exciting feeling. Invariably, people comment that the atrium, and the color of the marble particularly, is friendly and flattering, but also vibrant and energizing. All things you want people to feel when they shop. Comfortable, but also pumped up to spend money. Of course, the marble was only part of it. The whole atrium space was very dramatic and different. Rather than making the railings out of aluminum, which is cheap and practical, we used polished brass, which was much more expensive, but also more elegant, which blended wonderfully with the color of the marble. Then we used a lot of reflective glass, particularly on the sides of the escalators. That was critical, because it made a fairly small core space look far larger and more dramatic. The sense of spaciousness was further enhanced by the fact that we used only 2 structural columns in the entire atrium. The result is that no matter where you stand, you get an unimpeded view and a sense of great openness. The third element that adds to the drama of the atrium is one I actually fought against at first, making the entrance from Fifth Avenue unusually large. Zoning regulations required only a 15-foot width, and I didn't want to lose any more retail space that fronted on Fifth Avenue than I had to. However, the city pushed very hard for a 30-foot width, and finally, reluctantly, I went along. It cost me some very valuable retail square footage. But now I think that what I got instead, a spectacular entrance, was more than worth it. I give the City Planning Commission full credit for that. The last key element in the atrium was the waterfall that runs along the eastern wall. It's nearly 80 feet high, and it cost almost $2 million to build. Most of my people at first favored putting paintings on the walls. To me, that was old-fashioned, unoriginal, and just not very exciting. As it turned out, the waterfall proved to be an art form in itself, almost a sculptured wall. Also, it attracts far more attention than we'd have gotten if we'd put up even some very wonderful art. If most malls succeed in part because they're so safe and homogeneous, I'm convinced that Trump Tower Atrium succeeds for just the opposite reasons. It's larger than life, and walking through it is a transporting experience, almost as if you're in a wonderland. We tried to create a version of that feeling in the apartments themselves. The most dramatic element we had to offer, of course, was the views. Since the residential units didn't start until the 30th level, most were higher than the surrounding buildings, which meant they had views to the north of Central Park, to the south of the Statue of Liberty, to the east of the East River, and to the west of the Hudson. In addition, the sawtooth design of the building gave all the major rooms in the apartments views in at least 2 directions. And then, to make sure we took the best advantage of those views, we built huge windows, virtually from floor to ceiling. I would have made the windows all the way from floor to ceiling, but I was told that unless there is at least some base below a window, some people get vertigo. The funny thing is that the inside of the apartments was less important than a lot of the other elements. We quickly discovered that the sort of buyer who spends $1 million for a two-bedroom pied-à-terre, or $5 million for a four-bedroom duplex, is going to hire his own designer, gut the apartment, and rebuild it to fit his own tastes. In the end, the reason that we were able to charge unprecedented prices for the apartments was something beyond any specific luxuries we provided. It was the fact that, through some blend of design, materials, location, promotion, luck, and timing, Trump Tower took on a mystical aura. A lot of buildings can be successful, but I'm convinced that only one, at any given time, can achieve the blend of qualities necessary to attract the best buyers and command the top prices. Before Trump Tower, the last building to achieve that mystique had been Olympic Tower, on 51st Street off 5th Avenue, built in the 1970s. The key ingredient was the fact that Aristotle Onassis owned it. At the time, Onassis was living an amazing life. He was married to Jackie Kennedy and was the ultimate jet-setter with mansions around the world, a huge yacht, and even his own island, Scorpios. He was very rich and very hot, and while Olympic Tower wasn't a particularly exciting or attractive building, it was the right product done by the right guy at the right time. It absolutely stole the top of the market from another luxury building that went up around the same time, the Galleria on East 57th Street. As it turned out, Trump Tower also stole the market from one potentially major competitor. Long before I made my deal for the Bonwit site, another developer announced plans to build a huge condominium tower above the Museum of Modern Art, just off 5th Avenue at 53rd Street. By all rights, it should have been a fantastic success. The connection with the museum was very prestigious, the location was good, the architect, Cesar Pelli, was a big name, and the developer made it clear that he would spare no expense to build the best. However, Trump Tower far outsold Museum Tower. First of all, although we got started later on construction, we began selling apartments in Trump Tower around the same time that Museum Tower did. From the start, I could see we had some advantages. Obviously, we had a better location on 5th Avenue. But in addition, the shape of Museum Tower wasn't inspiring. The facade, with its multicolored glass, wasn't unusually striking, and the lobby was just another lobby. Finally, Museum Tower was marketed poorly. Their ads were dull. There was no attempt to create excitement, and it came off as just an average building. By contrast, we took our strengths and promoted them to the skies. From day one, we set out to sell Trump Tower not just as a beautiful building in a great location, but as an event. We positioned ourselves as the only place for a certain kind of very wealthy person to live, the hottest ticket in town. We were selling fantasy. The one market we didn't go after was old money New Yorkers, who generally want to live in older buildings anyway. On the other hand, we could appeal to several other categories of wealthy people. Obviously, we were a natural choice for people connected with show business, in the sense that we created something very glamorous. Foreigners were another big market. Europeans, South Americans, Arabs, and Asians. Practically speaking, we offered them an immediate advantage. At the time we began selling Trump Tower, it was virtually the only condominium in New York. To buy an apartment in a condominium, all you need is the purchase price. To buy a cooperative, which is what most buildings in New York were at the time, you need approval from its board of directors, who have ridiculous arbitrary powers, including the right to demand all kinds of financial data, social references, and personal interviews. Then they can reject you for any reason they choose, without explanation. It's a license to discriminate. The worst part is that many people on these co-op boards get their kicks from showing off their power. It's absurd and probably illegal, but it happened to be great for Trump Tower. Many wealthy foreigners didn't have the proper social references for these cooperatives, or didn't want to put themselves through the scrutiny of a bunch of prying strangers. Instead, they came to us. I still remember the morning, just before we began selling apartments, when one of my salespeople rushed into my office. "Mr. Trump," she said, "we're in trouble. Museum Tower just announced its prices, and they're much lower than ours." I thought for a minute, and I realized that actually the opposite was true. Museum Tower had just done itself damage. The sort of wealthy people we were competing for don't look for bargains in apartments. They may want bargains in everything else, but when it comes to a home, they want the best, not the best buy. By pricing its apartments lower than ours, Museum Tower had just announced that it was not as good as Trump Tower. A lot of people think that we set out to attract celebrities to Trump Tower, or that we hired a fancy public relations firm to promote the building. The truth is that we never hired anyone to do public relations. And every star who bought an apartment, Johnny Carson, Steven Spielberg, Paul Anka, Liberace, and many others, came to us. Nor did I give any of them special deals. Other developers cut prices to attract stars and celebrities. But to me, that's a sign of weakness. What really means something is when a celebrity is willing to pay full price for an apartment. If any press story about a celebrity helped promote Trump Tower, I suspect it was one about a sale that never actually occurred. Shortly after we began selling apartments, I got a call from a reporter asking whether or not it was true that Prince Charles had purchased an apartment in Trump Tower. It so happened that this was the week when Prince Charles and Lady Diana had gotten married. And they were, at that moment, the most celebrated couple in the world. Our policy was not to comment about sales. And that's what I told this reporter. In other words, I refused to confirm or deny the rumor. Apparently, the reporter then decided to call Buckingham Palace. By this time, the royal couple had left for their honeymoon, and they were out on the yacht Britannia. So the Buckingham Palace spokesman said just what I had. They couldn't confirm or deny the rumor. That was all the media needed. In the absence of a denial, the story that the royal couple was considering buying an apartment in Trump Tower became front-page news all over the world. It certainly didn't hurt us, but I had to laugh to myself. Just a month earlier, Prince Charles had come to New York for a visit, and the IRA had come out in force to protest. As Prince Charles walked into Lincoln Center for a concert one evening, hundreds of protesters stood outside, hissing and screaming and throwing bottles. It had to be a frightening experience for him, and I can't imagine it left Prince Charles with a great desire to take an apartment in New York City. Also, while Trump Tower is a great building, I suspect Prince Charles would find it very hard to get used to any apartment after growing up in Buckingham Palace. With so much demand, our marketing strategy was to play hard to get. It was a reverse sales technique. If you sit in an office with a contract in your hand, eager to make the first deal that comes along, it's quite obvious to people that the apartments aren't in demand. We were never in a rush to sign a contract. When people came in, we'd show them the model apartments, sit down and talk, and if they were interested, explain that there was a waiting list for the most desirable apartments. The more unattainable the apartment seemed, the more people wanted them. As demand grew, I kept raising the prices, 12 times in all. We started out selling for much more than Olympic Tower, which, until then, had been the most expensive building in New York. Within a short period, we'd almost doubled the price for the best apartments on the highest floors. People were buying two-bedroom apartments for $1.5 million. And before we finished construction, we'd sold a huge majority of the apartments. The cycles of buyers at Trump Tower became something of a barometer of what was going on in the international economy. At first, the big buyers were the Arabs, when oil prices were going through the roof. Then, of course, oil prices fell, and the Arabs went home. In 1981, we got a sudden wave of buyers from France. I wasn't sure why. But then I realized the reason was that François Mitterrand had been elected president, and anyone smart and wealthy realized immediately that Mitterrand was going to hurt the French economy. It wasn't just that he was a socialist. and that he began nationalizing companies. It was also that he turned out to be a dangerous man. What can you say about a guy who goes around selling nuclear technology to the highest bidder? It's the lowest anyone can stoop. After the European cycle, we got the South Americans and the Mexicans, when the dollar was weak, and their economies still seemed fairly strong. Then, when inflation set in, their currencies were devalued, and their governments tried to restrict the outflow of cash, that cycle ended. During the past several years, we've had two new groups buying. One is American, specifically Wall Street types, brokers and investment bankers who've made instant fortunes during the bull market frenzy. It's ridiculous when you think about it. You get stockbrokers, barely 25 years old, who suddenly earn $600,000 a year because clients they've never met call up and say, "I'll take 50,000 shares of General Motors." The broker pushes a button on a computer, and presto, he's got a huge commission. As soon as the stock market falls out, which it will, because it too runs in cycles, most of these guys will be out on the street looking for work. The other new buyers are the Japanese. I have great respect for what the Japanese have done with their economy. But for my money, they are often very difficult to do business with. For starters, they come in to see you in groups of 6 or 8 or even 12. And so you've got to convince all of them to make any given deal. You may succeed with 1 or 2 or 3, but it's far harder to convince all 12. In addition, they rarely smile, and they are so serious that they don't make doing business fun. Fortunately, they have a lot of money to spend, and they seem to like real estate. What's unfortunate is that for decades now they have become wealthier in large measure by screwing the United States with a self-serving trade policy that our political leaders have never been able to fully understand or counteract. Because the 263 apartments in Trump Tower proved to be so desirable, I decided to keep a dozen or so off the market, much the way a hotel operator always holds a few choice rooms free for emergencies. It was a way of keeping options open, particularly my own. Originally, I decided to take one of the 3 penthouse triplexes on the top floors, about 12,000 square feet in all, for my family. We moved in at the end of 1983. I had offers as high as $10 million for each of the 2 apartments adjoining mine, but I resisted selling them, figuring I might ultimately want more space myself. It proved true sooner rather than later. In the middle of 1985, I got an invitation from Adnan Khashoggi, a Saudi Arabian and a billionaire at the time, to come to his apartment in Olympic Tower. I went, and while I didn't particularly go for the apartment, I was impressed by the huge size of its rooms. Specifically, it had the biggest living room I'd ever seen. I had plenty of space in my triplex, but I figured, what the hell? Why shouldn't I have exactly the apartment I wanted, particularly when I built the whole building? I decided to take over one of the other apartments on the top 3 floors and combine it with mine. It has taken almost 2 years to renovate, but I don't believe there is any apartment anywhere in the world that can touch it. And while I can't honestly say I need an 80-foot living room, I do get a kick out of having one. Successful as we were in selling the Trump Tower apartments to the top buyers, we did at least as well in attracting the best retailers to the atrium. It began when Asbury, a London-based store that sells the finest crystal, jewelry, and antiques, selected the atrium for its first branch store in 200 years of operation. At first, they took a small store in the atrium. Business was so good that they have since expanded to a much larger space. Quality, of course, attracts more quality. The next thing we knew, we had leases with many of the world's top retailers. Asbury, Charles Jordan, Buccellati, Cartier, Martha, Harry Winston, and many others. It didn't hurt, of course, that in April 1983, just after the atrium opened, we got a good review from Paul Goldberger, who by then had replaced Ada Louise Huxtable, as architecture critic of the Times. The review was headlined, "Atrium in Trump Tower is a Pleasant Surprise." It began by saying, in effect, that other critics had been wrong. The atrium, Goldberger wrote, is turning out to be a much more pleasant addition to the cityscape than the architectural oddsmakers would have had it. The review went on to say that the atrium may well be the most pleasant interior public space to be completed in New York in some years. It is warm